It's Thursday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, Iran releases 10 U.S. sailors captured in Iranian waters.
I'm appreciative for the quick and appropriate response of the Iranian authorities.
We'll also look at what lifting of sanctions will mean for Tehran. Also, the House hears testimony about North Korea's nuclear intentions. President Obama hits the road to follow up his State of the Union speech, and Lincoln revives the Continental with an eye on Chinese buyers. That's all on today's International Edition. The United States has welcomed Iran's release of 10 U.S. Navy sailors Wednesday, one day after they drifted into Iranian waters and were detained. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that resolution of the incident was a success for diplomacy.
I also want to thank the Iranian authorities for their cooperation and quick response. These are always situations which, as everybody here knows, have an ability, if not properly guided, to get out of control. And I'm appreciative for the quick and appropriate response of the Iranian authorities.
American authorities are still unsure of the circumstances surrounding the crew's detention, in part because they have not yet been able to fully debrief the sailors. The freed Navy crew members, 9 men and 1 woman, are now at a U.S. facility in Qatar. Iran also released the 2 small patrol boats the Americans were using when they were detained. The sailors were traveling through the Persian Gulf from Kuwait toward Bahrain when U.S. controllers lost contact with them on Tuesday. Iranian Revolutionary Guards who patrolled the Gulf boarded the U.S. vessels and detained the crew members near Farsi Island, Iranian territory roughly midway between Kuwait and Bahrain. The State Department said there was no formal U.S. apology to Iran since the sailors' intrusion into Iranian waters was accidental. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted that he was happy to see dialogue and respect, not threats and impetuousness, swiftly resolve the sailors' episode. This incident came at a critical time for Iran. The United Nations nuclear watchdog group, the IAEA, is believed to be ready to confirm Iran has complied with the conditions for lifting international sanctions as part of a deal reached with world powers in July. I spoke with VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins about what is necessary to lift the sanctions and what it will mean for Iran's future.
There were several large hurdles for Iran to cross, and analysts say they have really made it to this point in really a remarkably short period of time, considering that the deal was just agreed upon in July. For one thing, they had to cut their uranium and plutonium enrichment abilities. That involved removing thousands of centrifuges and decommissioning a heavy water reactor at its AROC facility, among other things.
And I understand that Secretary Kerry was informed that the center part of that reactor has been removed and will be filled with concrete.
That's correct, and that's a major step forward for Iran, and it could be an indication that implementation day is near. There have been some reports that it will occur over the next few days.
What happens once implementation day takes place? What does that mean for Iran as far as its financial situation?
Well, Iran will be freed from nuclear-related sanctions, and these would be sanctions from the U.S., the U.N., and other world powers that were involved in the negotiations. There are other sanctions that will remain in place for its human rights record and other abuses. But in the short run, it could mean upwards of $50 or $60 billion in frozen assets. And these are Iranian assets, financial assets that have been frozen in banks overseas, could be made available. Also, Iran would have more freedom and more ability to do business with other countries, which would be a huge boost for its economy. One of the things that Iranian President Rouhani campaigned on is a pledge to boost the economy, and the freedom from sanctions under the nuclear agreement is seen as a path for him to do so.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins. Elsewhere, Pentagon Chief Ash Carter has spelled out U.S. strategy for retaking the Iraqi city of Mosul and Raqqa in Syria, cities he calls Islamic State's two power centers. Speaking to troops from the 101st Airborne Division in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, Wednesday, Carter said that those men and women will soon be deployed to Iraq to help train Iraqi and Kurdish forces to defeat the militants.
ISIL's a cancer that's threatening to spread. Like all cancers, you can't cure the disease just by cutting out the tumor. You have to eliminate it wherever it is spread and stop it from coming back.
Carter said he envisions sending Iraqi forces from the south and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters from the north to surround Mosul and cut it off. U.S. troops will also help train Syrian rebel forces to oust Islamic State from Raqqa in Syria, a city that the militants call their capital. The defense secretary said that U.S. Special Operations Forces deployed to Iraq in December are ready to go to work assisting the Iraqis.
And the Specialized Expeditionary Targeting Force I announced in December is now in place and is preparing to work with the Iraqis to begin going after ISIL's fighters and commanders, killing or capturing them wherever we find them, along with other key targets.
A U.S. airstrike earlier this week hit a building in Mosul storing Islamic State cash, sending millions of dollars in funds up in smoke. Carter announced Wednesday that he will go to Paris next week to meet with French, Australian, British, Dutch, German, and Italian defense ministers. Turkish authorities say five suspects have been arrested in connection with the deadly suicide bombing in Istanbul's Sultanahmet Square that killed 10 Germans and wounded 15 other people. Speaking to reporters in Istanbul, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said police arrested four more suspects Wednesday, adding that Islamic State's links to the attack had been confirmed. IS, however, has not claimed responsibility. Earlier, Interior Minister Ekfan Ala said that police detained a man late Tuesday, but did not give any further details on the suspect's identity or possible role. Ala said the bomber, that is, was not on a list of people wanted by Turkey. Authorities identified him as Nabil Fadli and said he was born in Saudi Arabia. Fadli had recently entered Turkey from Syria as a refugee, according to the Turkish Migration Office. Meanwhile, Germany's Interior Minister, Thomas de Maizière, traveled to Istanbul immediately after the attack. He told reporters that there is no sign that Germans were specifically targeted. He added that he sees no reason to refrain from traveling in Turkey. Accompanied by Davutoğlu, Maizière Wednesday visited an Istanbul hospital where the wounded from Tuesday's attack were being treated. Turkish police also arrested a number of suspected Islamic State militants during raids Wednesday, including three Russian nationals, in addition to several dozen detained on Tuesday. The Sultanahmet Square is Istanbul's main sightseeing area and home to the Topkapi Palace, the Blue Mosque, and the Hagia Sophia Museum. Time now for a look at some of the topics trending on the web. For that, we turn to our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. G., welcome.
Hi, David. The global economic outlook isn't looking great, and we knew that for a while, but this story is a pretty big argument for selling your shares. In a client's note, economists with the Royal Bank of Scotland told investors to sell everything. They warned the situation is similar to the global financial crisis that began in 2008.
That's pretty scary. Mm-hmm. So when was this note written, and what's the point?
So the note is dated January 8th and basically telling the investors to sell everything except high-quality bonds. It argued clients should be concentrating on return of capital rather than return on capital, meaning just try to get your principal and never mind the interest.
Now, what are some of the other takeaways with this?
The economists were bearish on China and global commodities. They also predict oil prices to fall to as low as $16 a barrel. The unemployment rate in developed countries will likely skyrocket on the back of an increase in automation.
Now, what's been the public reaction on social media?
For that, I went to the Wall Street Journal's Facebook page. It posted a link to the article, and here's a comment with the most number of likes. RBS has probably shorted the market. The harder the market falls, the more profit RBS would make. Self-fulfilling prophecy. And why would anybody share their strategy with other investors for free? So you can tell that people are not taking the advice at its face value, but there are a lot of flaws to the statement, by the way, which shows how little people understand about the financial market. First of all, it's shorting the stock, not a market. Short selling is a sale of the security that's not owned by the seller or that the seller has borrowed. Second of all, it's not sharing strategy with other investors. It's informing your clients who pay you to do that.
Now, what's the bank's Twitter handle?
It's at RBS Group, but has yet to tweet about the leaked client note. Before I go, I want to say that another story trending on the web is singer Patti LaBelle and her new boo. The 71-year-old found a new love, a drummer who is 30 years junior.
That's International Edition social media reporter G. Abby Lee. Speaking of financial markets, stock prices tumbled on Wall Street Wednesday with all three major indices lower. Fears of a global economic slowdown and alarm over falling oil prices sent the Dow Jones Industrial Average down by 2.2%. The S&P 500 fell 2.5%, its worst day since September 28th. The NASDAQ was down 3.4% when biotechnology stocks plummeted. In Europe, the markets were mixed. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.07%. Gold rose nearly $2 to $1,087.10 an ounce. Coming up, what can be done to deter North Korea from using a nuclear weapon? This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Researchers at Cornell University have made a finding that could lead to new and improved cancer treatments. Studying mice with metastatic prostate cancer, the research team discovered some powerful proteins that seek, attack, and then destroy cancer cells flowing in the bloodstream. The researchers created microscopic bubbles they filled with a protein called tumor necrosis factor-related apoptosis-inducing ligand, or TRAIL for short, and administered doses to the cancer-ridden mice. The TRAIL protein bubbles, which attach themselves to white blood cells, kill tumor cells as they travel through the bloodstream. The researchers found that the TRAIL protein prevents the creation and growth of tumors that can spread to other parts of the body. The treatment not only prevented the secondary tumors from developing, but the research team found that the mice's primary tumors had also shrunk in size. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd, reporting from Washington. Experts on North Korea and China testified on Capitol Hill Wednesday about Pyongyang's recent test of a nuclear bomb. Speaking to the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Victor Cha, the Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said that the notion that North Korea can keep several nuclear weapons and not be tempted to use them is incorrect.
North Korea is developing these nuclear capabilities at the expense of massive degrading of their conventional capabilities. And so what that means is if we're ever in a military crisis, they immediately have to shoot up the escalation ladder, and that immediately forces us to consider preemption. So it's a highly unstable situation.
Cha suggested that a miscalculation on the part of Pyongyang could lead it to fire a nuclear weapon at Japan or South Korea.
There are easily contingencies one can imagine where a country, especially North Korea, can miscalculate. And I can draw out some of those scenarios for you in which they have no intent to use nuclear weapons, but because of military miscalculations, they are then compelled to. And that is what's so inherently destabilizing about the current situation.
Bonnie Glazer is with the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She told the committee the United States might be able to enlist the Chinese government in helping reduce tensions in the region. Glazer added that negotiations with South Korea for a missile defense system supplied by the United States might help motivate Beijing to act.
And I do think that taking steps that defend American interests and the interests of our allies, and if they happen to create a more negative security environment for China in the region, that may motivate the Chinese to do more as well. This is not something that they want to see. It doesn't benefit their interests.
Last week, Glazer told the committee that the United States needs to engage North Korea to back away from the nuclear option.
we have to engage North Korea in a way that they understand that there are steps that they have to take. They have to go back to these commitments of giving up nuclear weapons. And if they're willing to go ahead with a freeze as a first step, toward, with the understanding that the goal is that they eventually give them up, then I think the United States has always been willing to work with that. I don't think there are signs that under Kim Jong-un that the North Koreans are willing to engage in serious negotiations with the end goal of denuclearizing the peninsula.
Last week, Pyongyang announced it had successfully tested its first hydrogen bomb. However, there has not been full independent confirmation of that claim. The U.S. House of Representatives voted nearly unanimously on Tuesday to pass legislation to broaden sanctions on North Korea. On Wednesday, South Korea urged China to apply more pressure to Pyongyang to step back from its nuclear saber-rattling. Coming up, President Obama takes his State of the Union priorities on the road. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
U.S. President Barack Obama took his State of the Union goals to the American people Wednesday with a speech to students in Nebraska. Mr. Obama told the cheering crowd in Omaha that Americans need to adhere to the values that made the country what he called the greatest country on earth.
It's not just that we've got a big military. It's not just that we've got a great economy. It's that in fits and starts, we figured out that if you treat everybody with respect and you give everybody a shot and everybody's working together, everybody's better off. Everybody's stronger. Everybody's religion is protected. Everybody's point of view is heard.
Mr. Obama called on the students gathered at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, to fulfill their obligation to stand up for what is right and to elect leaders who represent their values.
Our collective future depends on your willingness to uphold your obligations as citizens, to vote and to speak out and to stand up for others, especially those who are vulnerable, especially those who need help, knowing that we are only here because somebody else did that for us. That's how all of us are here.
Mr. Obama repeated his priorities to enhance education to help students get ahead, to reform immigration to keep the country safe, and to help Americans succeed in the world economy. From Nebraska, which Mr. Obama lost in the 2012 election, the president headed to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where he will spend the night ahead of an appearance there on Thursday. The White House said that Obama was visiting Nebraska and Louisiana because the states are good illustrations of how his policies are helping people. Unemployment in both states has fallen significantly since Mr. Obama took office. More than 2.5 million residents have gained coverage under his health care law, which the Republican presidential candidates unanimously oppose and have vowed to repeal if they are elected. In his last State of the Union address, President Obama challenged Americans to discover a cure for cancer and enlisted Vice President Joe Biden to head up the effort. His choice is particularly poignant considering Biden lost his son Beau to cancer just last year. Faith Lapidus reports on the details of the effort to eradicate this disease that kills more than 8 million people every year.
For the loved ones we've all lost, for the families that we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all. What do you say, John?
With those words, President Obama announced what the White House calls a new initiative to fight cancer, and he put his vice president in charge.
Because he's gone to the mat for all of us on so many issues over the past 40 years, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control.
Biden lost his son Beau to brain cancer in 2015. Since then, he's been vocal about his commitment to fighting the disease, saying this in October.
There are so many breakthroughs just on the horizon in science and medicine. The things that are just about to happen. And we can make them real with an absolute national commitment to end cancer as we know it today.
The American Cancer Society told VOA their hope is that the administration will create a strong central command and control function in the fight against cancer. But it says the announcement is important because it gives us a goal. People start thinking about it. Some of Biden's first efforts include a meeting on Friday with relevant cabinet secretaries to coordinate efforts to fight the hundreds, possibly thousands, of different diseases that constitute cancer. The vice president has spoken of the fight against cancer as a moonshot, a reference to the massive coalition of government and business in the 1960s that resulted in the United States putting the first man on the moon. It is a daunting task, but Sidney Kilmer Cancer Center researcher William Nelson says great progress is being made.
It's really only been in the last decade or so that we've been able to use technologies to ask, what are all the defective genes in any individual's cancer, and can we use that information to plot a treatment likely to be effective for that person? And every day that's more and more possible.
Next week, Biden will talk with international cancer experts at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. The White House says the effort has already begun, touting a $2 billion increase in funding for the National Institutes of Health in the recently passed federal spending bill. Biden says it is personal for him, for nearly every American, and for millions of people around the world. In October, when he decided against making a run for the presidency, Biden said, "If I could be anything, I would want it to be the president that ended cancer." Perhaps now instead he'll be remembered as the vice president who oversaw the beginning of the end of this deadly disease. For writer Kevin Enochs, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
The North American International Auto Show is underway in Detroit, Michigan, with pickup trucks, SUVs, and luxury cars stirring interest. It's also where Lincoln is launching its new version of the iconic car, the Continental, with an eye toward Chinese luxury car buyers. The Acadia is GM's crossover SUV, and General Motors hopes to take some of the market from other SUV makers like Nissan and Toyota. This year's Acadia is lighter by about 318 kilograms and is also about 17 centimeters shorter than previous models. All that adds up to better gas mileage, something that is still an issue even with lower worldwide oil prices. Mark Royce is GM's executive vice president.
It offers everything customers want in a premium crossover. Versatility and refinement, family-focused features, and technologies that make life easier and safer.
Nissan enters the market of high-performance pickup trucks with its Titan Warrior model. The diesel-powered concept vehicle has black-flared fenders and oversized tires. It's also taller and wider and comes with matte silver finish and orange accent stripes. Honda unveiled the next-generation version of its Ridgeline pickup truck, which features a 3.5-liter V6 and is available in front-wheel and all-wheel drive versions. Jessica Caldwell is a senior analyst with Edmunds. She says the truck category is rebounding after a severe downturn during the recession.
You know, after having such a downturn through the recession, that they're finally coming back up again. So I think that, you know, anything that automakers are showing from the Honda Ridgeline to the new Nissan Titan has a better chance in the market than it would have had a few years ago.
For those interested in luxury, Lincoln has rolled out its new Continental full-size sedan, with sales expected to start later this year in the United States and China. Lincoln stopped making the Continental in 2002 so it could focus on the LS, but it's reviving the legacy brand as part of a multi-year, multi-billion dollar comeback. Lincoln President Kumar Galhotra says the new Continental harkens back to a luxurious ideal the car is famous for.
The all-new Lincoln Continental, the future of quiet luxury coming this fall.
It is a contrast to machines of pure speed and raw horsepower that other luxury brands use as their calling card.
Jessica Caldwell of Edmunds says the new Continental offers beauty that buyers, especially in China, will like.
But I think really Lincoln as a brand, as it relates to the larger Ford dynasty, is probably more targeted towards China. And they like the larger sedans. They like the American luxury nameplates. You know, Buick does really well in China. I imagine they want to take a play out of their, you know, their playbook and try to, you know, take over that market as well.
Ford's president and CEO Mark Field says his company opened 33 dealers in China by the end of 2015. The North American International Auto Show runs through January 24th in Detroit. And the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences will announce its Oscar nominees later today in Los Angeles. The Revenant by Oscar-winning director Alejandro Iñárritu and starring Leonardo DiCaprio as a fur trapper is a leading candidate for Best Film. Spotlight is a tough and thought-provoking film about the investigative team of the Boston Globe newspaper that uncovered the massive scandal of child molestation in Boston's Catholic Archdiocese and beyond. Adam McKay's sleek, dark comedy The Big Short and its stellar cast of Christian Bale, Steve Carell, Ryan Gosling and Brad Pitt on the housing bubble collapse in the mid-2000s could also take home what Robin Williams called the Golden Dude. Eddie Redmayne, Michael Fassbender, and Leonardo DiCaprio are considered leading contenders for Best Actor. Cate Blanchett and Brie Lawson are favorites for Best Actress nominations. The winners will be announced February 28th in Los Angeles. Thanks for joining us for International Edition. Tracy Carter directed our program. John Ellison was our engineer. We welcome your questions or comments. You can send us a tweet at @VOA_IE. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you can log on to our website, voanews.com. Join us again Friday for another International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since October, five people connected to a publishing house in Hong Kong have mysteriously disappeared. The publishing house, Mighty Current, has published books critical of Chinese Communist Party officials, including Chinese President Xi Jinping. Guimin Hai, the owner of Mighty Current, vanished October 17th from a seaside apartment in Thailand. Later that month, two staff members of Causeway Bay Bookstore, which is partially owned by Mighty Current, went missing during a trip to mainland China. A fourth man connected to the publishing house also disappeared in October, most likely in Hong Kong or Xinjiang. On January 1st, reports surfaced that Li Bo, a business partner of Guimin Hai, had gone to visit a warehouse in Hong Kong used by the publishing company and did not return home. Hong Kong media have reported that security camera footage showed a mysterious man wearing a cap following Li Bo, both when he entered and exited the elevator of the warehouse. An eyewitness reportedly saw several people push Li into a van after he exited the building. Thousands of residents of Hong Kong took to the streets to protest the disappearances. Among other slogans, protesters reportedly shouted, "No to cross-border abductions," and "Stop political kidnapping." Hong Kong's chief executive, Lian Chunying, expressed concern over Hong Kong's residents' rights and safety and said it would be unacceptable if mainland Chinese authorities were seeking to enforce laws in Hong Kong. That, he said, would be a breach of the Basic Law, a document that enshrines the principle of one country, two systems, and guarantees Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy and its own legal system. The Basic Law also guarantees freedom of speech in Hong Kong. At a press briefing, U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said the United States is disturbed by reports of the disappearances of five people associated with the Mighty Current Publishing House. "We share the concern of the people of Hong Kong regarding these disappearances," said Mr. Kirby. "We noted the January 4th statement by Hong Kong's chief executive expressing concerns about the potential implications of this case, and we share those concerns."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.